sex, drugs, cigarettes, binge drinking, binge eating, gambling, shopping, excessive internet surfing, and all of this before 11 o'clock in the morning. I'm Jabalani LaFault, and on today's Central Standard, Dr. Bruce Leese joins us to talk about the psychology of addiction. We'll discuss the causes of addiction, as well as various habits that qualify as addictions even when there's no chemical that's been consumed. We'll also learn about addiction hopping, where we trade one addiction for another to compensate. We'd like to know from you, Kansas City, how you've overcome your addictions, large and small. And if you still struggle, call in to the Good Doctor for some advice and pointers on how to beat addiction. That's coming up on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. We all have wants, needs, desires, cravings, and appetites. And on the rare occasion when we achieve wants, needs, desires, and we satisfy cravings and appetites all in one moment, or at least tell ourselves that we did, we could end up spending a great deal of time and energy chasing that one moment. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFault. And today we examine the chase of that moment. We examine addiction, which, unlike the definition of insanity, is more like the things you do over and over again, expecting and wanting the same result. Joining us today to help us wade through addictive behaviors is Dr. Bruce Leese, professor of family medicine at KU. Dr. Leese, welcome back to Central Standard.
And thank you for having me. I always enjoy being here.
Once again, we begin with the overriding question on the topic of the day. What is addiction?
An addiction is any behavior that provides immediate or short-term gratification that feels good when you first do it, but that repetition would cause problems with. So if you do it over and over again, you're going to get in trouble with it. So anything you do over and over again that gets you in trouble, but that feels good up front, so you keep doing it.
A case study in the law of diminishing returns, as it were.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it. It really is diminishing returns. And one of the symptoms of an addiction is that you do more and more of it to get the same effect, trying to fight those diminishing returns. And you use the term chasing in your introduction, and a phrase that's heard often in the addictions world is chasing the high, still trying to get what you got at some point in the past that you're not going to get again. It'll never be the same.
Dr. Leese, regarding addiction, this has been a subject of great debate among addictions counselors and psychologists and psychiatrists and people who are familiar with addiction and addictive behaviors. Are addictions learned, or do they have more genetic origins?
There's good evidence for both of those arguments. So it's what's known as multifactorial. There are multiple factors that contribute to one becoming an addict. There is clearly a biological basis to all behavior, and especially to any behavior that's repetitive. The neural pathways in the brain are what's known as plastic. They're not literally plastic, but they bend and shift, much like plastic does. And as those shift and change, you know, there's a real medical physiological part going on that's in the brain, and at the same time, the behaviors are learned just like they have to be unlearned or changed behaviorally afterwards to make real change in one's life.
How are the behaviors learned?
There are lots and lots of ways that we learn addictive behaviors. Just the simple immediate gratification of certain kinds of things. It is immediately gratifying to eat one's favorite food. It is immediately gratifying to go shopping, hand over a plastic card, and to get back something that you think you love, and not have to really turn over any cash or feel any immediate pain. It is immediately gratifying for many people to consume alcohol and other drugs. So it's learned often by experimentation or the first experience. It can be cultural. There are cultures where food is so valued and prized that people rely on it for every kind of reward. There are cultures where alcohol is so valued and prized. And then there are cultures where the harder drugs are so valued and prized that, the whole culture kind of teaches you how to do it. Even shooting up heavy-duty addictive drugs is something that, is learned within a culture where that happens. I don't think anybody knows from birth how to take a syringe and, insert it into a vein and to inject heroin, for example.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I was just reading John Coltrane's biography, and it talked about how Charlie Parker sort of started this jazz culture among heroin users.
Absolutely.
Who thought that using it could give them an edge in improvisation, and it sort of became a widespread thing.
Absolutely. That's I know who both of those jazz greats are, but I hadn't heard that. I know it has to be true. And that's a culture that that probably felt pretty good for a while. Another interesting cultural experience is having older siblings and having them introduce what they're experiencing in high school or, even middle school to their younger siblings. That's a culture. That's an environment. It's in the family. Siblings are have their own little culture.
And we'll get more into the contextual environments that may lay the groundwork for addiction or make addiction more likely. But for now, how has the scope of addiction changed? We think of addictions, we immediately think of someone strung out on drugs or scratching themselves in the middle of the street looking for a fix. But in what ways have addiction become broader?
That's a that's an interesting history to look at. The more and more technologically advanced we get, the more and more access we have not only to things that are immediately gratifying, but also those contexts like instant messaging and, all kinds of technology actually make even the traditional addictive behaviors more appealing. So over the many hundreds and thousands of years that we've been involved in addictive behaviors, actually there are multiple citations in, the Bible to the consumption of alcohol. And so how has addiction changed over the years? I see people who have addictions to watching television. And again, by addictions, they get so much gratification immediately by just flopping down on the couch that they lose track of time. They lose track of the fact that they're not physically healthy. They lose track of everything. And hours can go by. And you know, so there was a time when there wasn't television, so people couldn't have gotten addicted to television, to answer your question about the changing trends. And, then, of course, all of the media surrounding the computer, the internet, and, messaging of all different kinds have changed everything.
And it's all interconnected because, as you mentioned earlier, binge eating and shopping can be addictions, and a lot of that is fostered by the internet or television or advertising.
I can't get on my computer each day without seeing a picture, an image, a photograph of a sumptuous meal. As soon as I sign on to my computer in the morning, just going through my email, there are certain companies that offer group discounts to wide ranges of people. But there's always a photograph of some steak or salmon or shrimp or something that you. Your mouth waters just looking at the picture. So, you know, again, the internet introducing or reminding us of all the things that are tasty and desirable and delicious, and we need it, we want it, we got to have it.
And these things are appealing and cool and desirable to the naked eye.
Yeah, I've been watching episodes of Mad Men on video, and it's so interesting because back in the day. You know, they had black and white television, and it was local only. And if you turned on the TV, you didn't see something that would make your mouth water. And now, it's just amazing. It's just amazing how much marketing can hit the bullseye and make us want the thing that we think we need and will make us feel better and instantly gratify us.
Whatever the addiction is, though, large or small, whether it's accepted as an addiction, why do we turn to it?
We don't want to accept that a central part of life is suffering, that as we grow and change from birth to death, from cradle to grave, we're faced with challenges that are difficult and big, and we want comfort. The Rolling Stones' famous song, "I Can't Get No Satisfaction," is all about suffering. We look for escapes from suffering. All fallible, imperfect human beings like you and me look for relief from the challenges in our life.
Speaking of addiction, there's a story around that song about Keith Richards where he fell asleep and woke up hearing the riff in his head.
I've heard that. I've heard that, right? I'm not surprised.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us today to help us wade through addictive behaviors is Dr. Bruce Leese, professor of family medicine at KU. Kansas City, what addictive behaviors, socially palatable or not, have you encountered either with yourself or your loved ones? We welcome your comments, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Share your stories with us. You can holler at us via email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Also, Twitter is an option, at KCURCST. What are the traits, Dr. Bruce Leese, of addictive behaviors?
I think the number one trait or characteristic or symptom of an addictive behavior is the diminished control a person has over the behavior. So if I only meant to sit down and watch the news and 5 hours later I realize I've fallen asleep on the couch, that is diminished control. I set out to do one thing and something else happens. If I think, well, I'm just going to hop on the internet and check my email, and hours later I'm still on the internet, that's diminished control. So diminished control is a big part of it. If I meant to have just one beer and the night is, it's late and I've had multiple, then that's diminished control. Psychologically, the preoccupation with the addictive behavior, for people who have eating problems, they know what I'm talking about. It's breakfast is over and what's for lunch already before they've even digested their food. Tolerance, the more you get, the more you need. That's another symptom of addictive behavior. Withdrawal, that's discomfort when you're SSI. I have a lot of people who say, I have no problem with whatever, television, cigarette smoking, alcohol, whatever it is. They say, I don't have a problem with it. It doesn't affect my life at all. I see no reason to change. Well, I always say to them, try a day without your addictive behavior and see if you don't have a problem with it, because they have at least psychological withdrawal if it has become an addiction. It interferes with activity, other activities. It deteriorates our sense of well-being, financial loss, all the time it takes. Lots and lots of stuff is associated with addictive behaviors.
At what point does it start to interfere with other activities? A lot of people who struggle with addiction have said that you simply don't intend to do it, but you wake up one day and realize you're sick.
It really creeps up on people. It really does creep up on people. There are some people who start an addictive behavior and within days or weeks, they're so wrapped up in the culture around it that they're in trouble. Other people can go for years and years and years and years, and until they have, until other people say, you're in really big trouble, they don't know it, or until they get a DUI, or until they have a heart attack. A big job of primary care physicians is to inform people that your lifestyle caused this problem. And by lifestyle, they're typically talking about addictive behaviors, overeating, overdrinking, not enough exercise because they're too busy watching television, etc.
816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also holler at us about your experiences with addictions, either with yourself or loved ones or people you know, or general questions about addictive behaviors. Holler at us via email at centralstandard@kcur.org. Twitter is also an option. Our handle there is at KCURCST. Dr. Leese, in recovery programs, some of the more mainstream and popular and well-known ones, addictions are treated as a disease, but other non-chemical dependency scenarios that we discuss, binge eating, gambling, maybe excessive sex, excessive internet use, is it more of a choice? When does it come down to a disease diagnosis versus a choice?
There's a very interesting history surrounding the disease model is what it's called, the disease model of addictions. And it's an important one for people to understand. First of all, the word disease means – I mean it comes from putting dis
and
ease.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, we can call anything a disease that causes us to be diseased. Prior to the disease model of addictions and alcoholism in particular, they would throw the so-called drunks in jail to dry out. They'd throw them in the tank, as they said. Treatment of people with addictions was pretty cruel prior to the disease model. Fortunately, various physicians, medical professionals of their time, I think it was in the 1800s, really began to care for and care about people with addictions. And as a result, they started to medicalize it, which was really good for people who were addicted. There's controversy. Here's what I believe the truth to be. I believe the truth of the disease model is that it's very useful. I believe the truth is that all behavior is brain and biologically based. I couldn't talk to you if there weren't neurons firing back and forth right now as we talk. So there's a biochemical association that's very important. There's clearly a genetic component because these things are passed on. Even when twins have never met each other, they tend to have some addictive behaviors. So there's a lot of evidence for the disease model, but it's always a choice to lift up that glass of beer or to put that cigarette in your mouth or to eat the brownie or to get on the internet and have pornography and to spend an hour or two with pornography. It is always a choice. If it weren't, I'd be pretty discouraged about what I do for a living.
We're talking about addictive behaviors with Dr. Bruce Lee, a professor of family medicine at KU, and we want to hear from you about your questions surrounding addictions and your stories surrounding addictions and addiction recovery. Adrian in Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. I noticed one of the things, and this is over time, that I realized is that coming up in a family of abuse, I had caught myself being in an addictive role as far as with certain family members had to playing a role, even though that role was no longer appropriate for the situation. But one of the biggest things was, I think, the freedom of not really being able to accept myself for all of my shortcomings. I feel like there was always has to be a fix there where I would have to try to cure other people's, you know, discomfort and at the same time losing myself. And then one thing I just realized now is that, sad to say, that was an addictive behavior. And I know from that point now, I've really gotten a lot more help as I became to learn and love more of myself. But I just thought I would share that with you all.
Thank you very much, Adrian, for sharing that. Talk about that context and how it manifests in the context of addictive behaviors.
I want to echo what you just said. Adrian, congratulations and thank you for your call. Adrian brings up some really interesting and important points. The development of an addiction in the culture of a sick or dysfunctional or troubled family, the development of that addiction really has profound effects, not just in the person's potential to get addicted, but also in their efforts to rescue the people they love. And it becomes a terrible, vicious cycle. Most addictions, including internet pornography, et cetera, begin in adolescence. And what's tragic, from my standpoint as a psychologist, what's tragic about that occurring is not only does the addictive behavior start to develop then, but psychological, emotional, and interpersonal growth can clearly be retarded by engagement in addictive behaviors because they compensate for skills that should have existed. And some people never develop those skills because they don't get to use them at a vital point in their adolescent development.
We're going to Melissa in Lawrence. We're talking about addictive behaviors today with Dr. Bruce Lee. Melissa, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yes. I'd like to talk about my experience with addiction. I am a normal housewife with two children. And basically, I have a great house, a great life, a great husband, pretty much everything I had ever wanted. And what happened was, I started out, I had an injury for ankle pain and started out with a prescription drug, a minor prescription drug habit, which ended up spiraling into several years of IV drug use of pharmaceuticals.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very, very solitary activity that I'm lucky that I still have all of these things. I still have my family. I still have my husband. I still have everything. I've been clean for 2 years now on a methadone maintenance program. But a lot of people wonder, you know, how in the world could this happen to someone like you?
Congratulations on your sobriety there, Melissa, and thank you for sharing your story with us. We're going to get Dr. Bruce Lease to chime in on that. A normal housewife with a quote-unquote normal life with everything anybody could ever want or the things that they say they want, yet IV drug use.
Yeah, I'm not going to psychologize on this one. I'm going to talk about what I believe to be the appropriate application of the medical model. So many people are on pain medication who, when the pain is over, they can't wait to get off of it. I do believe that some people are biologically and there's so much evidence, this they're biologically predisposed for substance dependence. So I'm only speculating here, and I want to emphasize that. I suspect that, you know, Melissa had some kind of biochemical brain, dopamine-related neurotransmitter kind of predisposition for becoming addicted, because most people who are put on pain medication do get off it. most of them do get off it without any adverse effects. And if I were talking to her at length, I'd ask questions like, you know, do you have a family history of addiction? And when I say I won't psychologize, I'm not going to say it's because you had a bad family or any of that stuff.
Well, let's talk to her. Melissa, are you still on the line?
I am.
Terrific.
How did you end up kicking it, and what was your family history?
Family history is very, very strong.
That's exactly.
My father committed suicide. He was when I was 7 years old. He was heavily addicted to methamphetamines. History of alcoholism throughout the family. The family history was very, very strong. And I would say that what really happened was there must have been some type of deficiency, because when I first used those drugs, the opiates, I felt right for probably the first time ever.
Yep.
It felt right. I felt this is how I'm supposed to feel. And I was superwoman and super mom and super wife until things got out of hand.
You know, Melissa, even though I hear these stories every day, my answer is wow. I mean, it's just each time I hear this, I can't congratulate you enough on your willingness to do everything you needed to do to get off the drugs.
But it is so frightening because it's a lifelong danger.
And you know, by calling in and talking about this, you're educating other people. If it feels really good when you're put on pain medication, if it doesn't just take the pain away and you start to feel like you never felt before, it's probably most important for you to get off the pain medication as quickly as you can.
Absolutely. I would advise anyone take extreme caution, you know, especially if you have that connection feeling like I did.
Yes.
There was just, like I said, there was just something that had to be deficient to click that way in the first place.
Thank you once again, Melissa, for contributing to this conversation with your story. And we are talking about addictive behaviors with Dr. Bruce Lease. We got an anonymous email at centralstandard@kcur.org where the emailer writes, "What about sexual addictions? Is it really an addiction or merely selfishness?" He or she says, "I look at pornography a lot. This has compromised my relationship with my wife." So, yes, it is a he. "What can I do?" is what he asks.
I'm going to make a few comments in response. Just a little background on whether something is or isn't an addiction, whether something is or isn't a disease. I'm a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. I have a PhD, not an MD. And yet, most of us who are psychologists have a great deal of respect for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. That is the manual that comes out every 5 to 15 years that defines what is a psychiatric illness. They're in volume 4 and they're moving to volume 5, and they are actually starting to list the ones that have had a good research base.
In the DSM-5, as you mentioned,
yes,
they're adding internet usage to it?
Yeah, it's in the past it was substance abuse or substance use disorders. There was nothing about addictions. In the new version, it's going to be substance use disorders or substance abuse. It hasn't been decided for sure yet. And addictions, addictive behaviors. And gambling is definitely in. Internet is in as a possibility. These other addictive behaviors will probably get in, but they want to do more research on it. So sex, we'll talk about sex because that was the question.
He's asking, is it merely addiction or merely selfishness?
I wouldn't use the word merely for either. They're both pretty significant and serious. I wouldn't label it selfish. Again, an addiction, behavioral addiction is a behavior, a set of behaviors that provides immediate gratification, and few people would say sex isn't gratifying. It's immediate gratification, and even if it's pornography-induced, and it's costing. It's resulting in long-term difficulty. I'm guessing that the reason he still does it, since we know it's a he, is because when he tries to stop, it's very uncomfortable because of what I originally said, the preoccupation, which leads to a diminished sense of control. So cold turkey stopping it is very wise.
One of the things you hear about addiction is when you can stop, you don't, and when you want to stop, you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go to Matt in KCK. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Good. Hey, I wanted to echo what the housewife was saying. I spent all of my life feeling unsatisfied, and I got hooked on methamphetamines, and when I shot dope, I was finally satisfied. I mean, it made everything just right. I mean, everything. And it took everything away from me eventually, and I eventually ended up taking my addiction all the way to the end of the line and learned how to manufacture dope and finally got arrested for cooking dope. And once I got arrested, I was allowed Senate Bill 123, which gave first-time dope cooks treatment. And I moved from my hometown to Kansas City and got clean. And it's been a good life after that. But, I still feel unsatisfied sometimes. And so I have to go to a lot of meetings.
Congratulations, Matt, on that. And thank you for contributing to our conversation. Is there such a thing, Dr. Bruce Lease, as an addictive personality? And if you'd like to address Matt's comments first, you can definitely feel free to do that.
Oh, I think I'm going to get goosebumps with every caller. I mean, I think it's so courageous. I've never had an addiction. My background is in psychology, and then there was research money in addictive behavior. Yeah, you look
no,
at me no like
addictions
you
know, at all.
Okay,
because you said that they extend beyond chemicals.
The number one addiction in the country happens to be caffeine. So I know I have that one.
Well, there you go.
I come from an obese family,
right.
So I always have to watch my eating. I could easily get addicted to binge eating if I didn't worry about giving me all kinds of secondary diseases. So anyway,
which
personality? Go ahead.
Personality. It's interesting, and this is sort of a subset to the question. Addictive personalities, does too much of anything make you an addict?
No, because if when you put it on a balance, it doesn't cause you more damage than it does good, if it does as much good as damage, I would argue it's probably not an addiction. And addictive personality, I would stay far from that concept. I think that addictions have profound impacts on personalities, and personalities have profound impacts on addictive potentiality.
We're talking about addiction here on Central Standard today, and our guest is Dr. Bruce Lease, professor of family medicine at KU. It's time for a break. When we return, we discuss addiction during the holiday season, the phenomenon of addiction hopping, plus steps to recovery. Kansas City, what addictions have you overcome, or what addiction are you helping a loved one through? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Facebook is also an option, and our Twitter handle is at KCURCST. Central Standard returns in a moment. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. British actor Russell Brand said of his addiction, "Even as a junkie, I stay true to vegetarianism. I shall have heroin, but I shan't have a hamburger." What a sexy little paradox, he says. We now continue our discussion about addiction, and our guest is Dr. Bruce Leese, professor of family medicine at KU. We'd also like to hear from you, Kansas City, on your experiences with addictive behaviors. What addictive behaviors, socially palatable or not, have you encountered either with yourself or loved ones? What specifically has helped you or others get through these addictions as well? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And you can also tweet us at KCURCST. What is the contextual basis, Dr. Bruce Leese, for addiction? We talked about social environment, career, family. What's the contextual basis?
Well, if people were never exposed to an addictive behavior, they probably wouldn't have addictive behaviors. Now, certainly there was a first discoverer of wine or beer, and certainly there was a first discoverer of caffeine and all those other things. But after that first discovery, the context becomes an environment where those things flow freely. So a lot of the context of addictive behaviors is the physical context, the community, the neighborhood, the social environment, including friends and family, one's chosen career. You can imagine how many bartenders drink heavily and don't even think of it as out of the ordinary. It's just what's happening all around them. Another contextual matter, and this is just coincidence, is the holidays. We are approaching holidays where everything is plentiful. Everything is plentiful. Everything that's good for us and everything that's not good for us is plentiful. So that's the context, and we get to go from there.
Emily, welcome to Central Standard. You're in Overland Park. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yep, go right ahead, Emily.
I just wanted to share a story of my sister who has been dealing with addictive behavior since her early 20s, and she's now 38 years old. She actually has been compulsively spending to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. And it's been a real strain in our family. We have a large family, and we've all tried to help her. She recently, because of her debt, had to leave her home, lost her job, and we actually supported her for quite some time, but I was never able to truly reach her and help her change that behavior. Despite offering her, you know, counseling and psychiatrists, she's also dealing with depression, and I was wondering if the compulsive spending is a manifestation of the depression or if it's a separate diagnosis of its own.
Thank you very much, Emily, for a very thoughtful question. And we have sympathies for what you're going through. Dr. Bruce Leese, tell us what's up with that.
The question of whether or not the depression causes the compulsive spending or the compulsive spending causes the depression is an intriguing one. The safe but also most rational answer is that it becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah, it's a circular flow.
Yeah, where the compulsive spending is probably used as a mood regulation operation. You're trying to make yourself feel good. You're trying to regulate your mood. Or I'll be more specific, Emily's sister is trying to regulate her mood by spending money. And depression is going to be the inevitable outcome of all that can be lost by spending on things that just sit in the closet for years and years. There are lots of people have problems with obsessive, compulsive, addictive spending. A lot of people say that they don't even remember buying the things they buy. So this particular addiction tends to most occur from my experience what I've seen. It tends to most occur in people who either were rewarded heavily when they were young with material things or didn't have much when they were young.
You
it
talked
fills
about,
a void.
And you talked about Christmas. This behavior is encouraged.
Yeah, I heard an interesting NPR report. It was on one of the money shows, Marketplace. They were giving advice to people during the shopping spree that inevitably goes on this time of year. And brilliant recommendation, so intuitive. Don't buy things for yourself during the holidays. I mean, who doesn't do that? Who doesn't see something they like and say, well, I need that, and it's on sale? So anyway, it's a terrible, terrible destructive addiction, compulsive, that spending thing where you look to buying things for relief from suffering.
John tweets to us at KCURCST, video games, wow, in caps, he says, stole years of his life and stressed out relationships, finally freed through redirecting passions to education. Thank you, John, and congratulations for getting your education, as it were. Dwight in KCK, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. How are we doing today?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Very well, thank you. My question is it possible to be addicted to video gaming, online gaming? Because I would drop a couple $100 on a video game. And just, you know, there's times that I would wake up at 6 o'clock and I'm like, look at my clock, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning, and I have to be at work at 7. Is that possible to be addicted to it, or is it just a pastime? Or
we just heard from John via Twitter, Dwight, who said video games stole years of his life and stressed out his relationships. So let's now hear from Dr. Bruce Lease on what he thinks clinically and cognitively.
Well, again, the new diagnostic manual of mental disorders that will be published by the American Psychiatric Association here soon has picked gambling, which is a lot like a spending addiction, and internet addiction as ones that will go in there somewhere. And so the answer is yes, yes, and yes. The average time spent at game – well, this all starts for most people in adolescence. I don't know how old you are when you started, but people
– I'm 36, and I only started playing online about 5 years ago.
Right. Well, I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but some people delay moving out of adolescence for mm-hmm. quite some time after they are actually in their teens and 20s.
Dwight, you're 36. Do you remember Nintendo or Sega?
Yeah, I remember Nintendo, but, you know, my immediate family, like my mom, she was a single mom, so she could never afford it, you know.
Right.
So we never had those video games. And not
right.
Like, you know, not until I became an adult and I could afford the games and, you know, because the system is like $300 and then the game itself is about $60, but then you have to buy like these map packs. So, like, you average about $200 per game.
Well, this is such an interesting – your background is so interesting, and I mean that sincerely. You know, your background would leave you wanting for the things people have in this world. You guys didn't have much. And when you became old enough to start paying your own bills and buying things for yourself, you discovered.
Yeah, just like a kid, I was envious of my cousin because he had all the cool stuff. You know, I was like, wow.
So,
you know.
So in some ways, you're throwing yourself back into adolescence with these
uh-huh.
games. It's interesting, an interesting factoid here. They did some research on the amount of time kids spend with interactive video games, like World of Warcraft was one that's been popular. Mm-hmm. The average time spent at games by kids who really get into it's about 25 hours a week, which happens to correspond with the average full-time high school week, and it's a lot
right.
of time.
Thank you very
much. I'm more of a Call of Duty guy, and you know, I get off at work around 3, and I work, like, I'll play from, like, 3 to 10 when it's time to hit the sack. And
3 p.m. to 10 p.m., Dwight?
Yeah.
Wow.
So let me state the obvious. It's time for you to grow in new directions.
Yo, Dwight, we got to go now, man. Thank you for calling.
Thank
your conversation and joining. We're going to go to John. We're going to kind of continue that conversation. He's the guy who tweeted in about his video games. John, we just heard from Dwight. 7 hours on Call of Duty, man. Wow.
All right. Here it goes. No past history, no family addiction. I read a book during my end of gaming. It was by Jane McGonigal called Reality is Broken. And she talked about, so I'm an intellectual. I'm in school. I'm working on my graduate. I'm thinking about law school. This is not, for me, replacing a childhood thing. What she talked about in her book was that your daily challenges, and this is for, I played World of Warcraft, and that 5 to 6 hours a day, that's during the week. I would hit 18 hours on a Saturday. And it sounds silly, and it's ridiculous. It's absurd. But the challenges of the everyday life are so slow. You work, you get a high five, you get said it wasn't a good job, but there's no immediate reward. In these games, you get win, you get loss, you get challenged, you overcome on a regular basis so quickly that it's more rewarding mentally than it is on an everyday basis. So I was having trouble. Like, I had been stressed with my relationships. I had girlfriends that said, you have to stop. I went cold turkey and I'd get the shakes. It was so weird. I thought about it when I was not there. And so eventually I grew up and accepted that a family requires income and I need to redirect this passion. I need to be obsessed or addicted to my career. And so it took like a time where the game was tapering down. There's expansion coming out. I was the best I could possibly be, and I closed the book. I kind of came to this chapter where I am done, and I set it down, and I redirected, and now I work full-time, and I go to class full-time, and I'm thinking about law school, I'm thinking about my career, and how I can take my obsession to be better than anybody I work with at the job that I can do. So it was just more challenge every day on things you didn't think you could do, and I feel like I'm pretty smart. It's kind of odd for me to get sucked into something that I couldn't control.
Thank you very much, John, for your contribution to the conversation. And we see that all addictions are not chemical. Some of them that are not chemical are pretty ridiculous. But this is an interesting point here that brings us to our next question. We hop, so to speak, to our next question. Addiction hopping. John literally says, now I'm addicted to my career. Like it's a cool thing.
I'm going to make a self-indulgent statement here. I work with people with addictions because it's so exciting watching what happens to people like John when they figure out what's going wrong and they start turning their lives around. I mean, there's no other problem I've worked with, depression or anxiety, where the turnaround is so profound and the insights gained when people do gain insights from their addictive behaviors. I mean, there's just nothing like working with people with addictions. So really appreciate the callers today and all the people in my career have taught me so much about addictions. John said something profound. He said there are no immediate rewards out there, and these games give you immediate rewards. Does everybody remember that expression, there's no such thing as a free lunch? I mean, there are no immediate rewards that are really durable. We have to work hard for those things in our lives that will sustain us, that are rewarding, that give us peace and tranquility and comfort in the world.
We were mentioning the show Mad Men, and Don Draper has this famous soliloquy where he says, what is happiness? It's the moment until you decide you need more happiness.
That's great.
So that definitely applies here. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us today to help us wade through addictive behaviors is Dr. Bruce Lease, professor of family medicine at KU. We're talking addictions. Let's go to Roy in KCMO. Roy, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
The reason I'm calling in, sir, is that I have a sister that is college educated, extremely intelligent, always excelled in high school, college, professionally, one of the most have strong perseverance, always, you know, done well on that side of the fence. On the personal side of the fence, with regard to relationships, she has just always gravitated to the guys that are tend to be the bad boy, if you will, the guy you don't want to have brought home for Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner. And my question is, you know, I try to tell her, you deserve better than this. You know, why? How can I break her or throw her a lifeline to pull her back to, you know, dating the type of guy that you do want to see her with?
Roy, thank you very much for your contribution to the conversation. Dr. Bruce Lease, the old Robert Palmer, might as well face it, you're addicted to love.
I wrote that down on my piece of paper here.
We're in sync.
I wrote addicted
to
love.
We're in sync.
There's no such thing as addiction to love because love is healthy. Now, all the illusions that pose as love, like
romance,
infatuation, people, because of the, you know, the romanticized love that we see in the movies, et cetera, and in literature, we fantasize and imagine that love is just a feeling. It's not. It's a whole way of being. People who get into trouble with love often are not, they're not really involved in love. Roy's sister, and I tip my hat to you if I were wearing a hat, Roy's sister is in a bad pattern. I mean, she's probably more seeking comfort that she's not going to find from people who aren't good for her. That's stating the obvious. But I wish we could just love people out of their bad behaviors, bad for themselves. I wish Roy could love his sister out of her bad behavior, bad for herself. I don't know that there is anyone that can cause anyone else to make changes in their behaviors. It's my whole career, and I haven't found the silver bullet. But
not at all. What can we do as loved ones to help others?
Insight. Insight is a really powerful tool that I most value when trying to help people. I will speculate. A lot of times, I have always said to my unfortunate daughter, because she had me as a father, I've always said to her, you know, you're going to grow up to marry somebody just like your father. I think we're pulled to people who remind us of how we grew up, or we race to avoid people like when we grow up. So I would ask Roy, you know, I'd tell Roy, talk to your sister about her dad. Is she looking to people who treat her like her dad? Or because most people who have really loving, nurturing fathers, if they're girls, or mothers, if they're boys, or if they're – anyway, most people get pulled to people like what they grew up with.
We differentiated between the concept of love, the Greek agape love, the unconditional, and the eros, romantic love. Can romantic love, in fact, be an addiction? It produces a chemical change in the brain.
Oh, my gosh. Anybody who hasn't experienced that chemical change in the brain of infatuation, from infatuation, has missed out. But it's an illusion. What happens when we feel the feelings, the drive, the magnetism of being pulled to something that's not good to us, good for us, what happens when we're pulled to that is we start to tell ourselves lies. Oh, he'll change. I can change him. You know, maybe I'm doing something to cause his misbehavior. So there's a biological component.
It's a lot of he, man. What about the she? You make a lot of...
Only because of Roy's sister here. But yes, you're right.
I
have worked with men who choose women who are not healthy. And they spend a lot of their lives trying to... I call it reparative dating or reparative marriages, where you pick somebody that you think you can fix. It won't happen. I mean, it's not your job, and it shouldn't be.
Serial monogamy, no milk. Jim, Lawrence, Kansas. Yes. Welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, thank you. How much do you think our culture has to contribute to preparing our children for addiction as cultures learned behavior? And there's plenty of examples around them as they're growing up. But also, recently, alcohol was classified as a gateway drug, and I'm curious if you would define a gateway drug that will, if you try it, you inevitably have to go to a harder drug. And also, the people that I know that have been addicted, it seems as if the more of an emotional problem they have, the harder the drug they need. And as much as a lot of people do soft drugs or do addictive things that really don't hurt anybody and themselves, but yet don't go on to do or increase their addiction, whether it's something they do or something they eat or something that they smoke. What do you think?
Okay, I've written down the questions. Number one question was about education. We don't educate our kids enough. Many years ago, back in the 60s and 70s, the concept of deliberate psychological education was proposed by a really outstanding education department, actually the School of Education at Columbia University, Teachers College, and the public rejected it. The public doesn't want people to educate their kids about psychological matters. So that fell away, unfortunately, and we don't do enough to educate our kids.
But the media does. And to his question about culture, I myself woke up this morning with this song playing in a loop, where the chorus is, you take a pool full of liquor and you dive in it.
Yeah.
Randomly.
That's right. And we try to stop things like that from happening, which we'll never do. I mean, music like that. And we try to get rid of the uglies instead of introducing the beauty of good education. A couple other questions you asked are really good ones. Gateway drug. There's no such thing as a drug that inevitably leads to other drugs or addictive behaviors. But once people get exposed at a young age, they get exposed to mind-altering chemicals, they naturally develop a curiosity about what the other ones might be like, and they might be in a culture where they're exposed to it, a culture of their neighborhood.
Well, let's discuss in these waning minutes here the stages of the shelf life of addiction.
The shelf life. Well, this is now among the most important concepts that are looked at in the research on addictions, the stages of change. Because addictions inevitably correspond with relapses, they wouldn't be addictions if people didn't try to stop and had trouble stopping. So the stages of change all have to do with relapse. Once we get into something we shouldn't be doing, like smoking cigarettes, when we ignore our problem, we're in the first stage, which is pre-contemplation. We're not even contemplating that we have a problem. Hopefully, before we get emphysema or heart disease, if we're cigarette smokers, from contemplation, hopefully we'll start to contemplate. Maybe I have a problem. That's stage two. Stage three, if I've contemplated I have a problem, I may start to prepare to change. I may decide I may hear that Jabalani LaFall on Central Standard has a show on addictions today, so I'm going to listen to it, maybe to prepare, maybe learn a few things to make my changes. After that, hopefully action takes place where the changes begin. And when people start to change their addictive behaviors in the action stage, stage four, that's when they're most vulnerable. That's when they are most likely to fall back into using. And then finally, maintenance is 6 months after change. So anyone who's in maintenance who's listening, congratulations. Anyone who's in the action stage, keep working. Keep at it. Don't quit. Don't give up on abstaining.
We're discussing addiction, and our guest is Dr. Bruce Leese, professor of family medicine at KU. Dr. Leese, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss this topic.
I'm Brian Ellison.
You are welcome. I always feel very, very fortunate to be here, so thank you so much.
You can hear this program and others on anger, forgiveness, mindfulness, and self-esteem with Dr. Leese, and subscribe to podcasts and other archived materials at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow as we begin the first in our two-part series examining the new American city. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Brian Ellison is up to date. Next, I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.